Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. In November of last year, the Pew Research Center survey found the share of Americans who say science has had a mostly positive effect on society continued to decline since surveys done before the pandemic. The survey also found a continued decline in public trust in scientists. The good news, overall, 57% of Americans still say science had a mostly positive effect on society. Today, we discuss strategies for scientists to improve communication with the public about research and findings, and perhaps begin to rebuild trust between the public and science. Joining us is Anne Toomey. She's the Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at Science at Pace University. She's the author of the new book, Science with Impact: How to Engage People, Change Practice, and Influence Policy. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Heather Goldstone's with us as well, Chief Communications Officer at Woodwell Climate Research Center. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Mindy. Hi, Anne. Good to be here.
And Chris Gloninger, he's the senior climate scientist at the Woods Hole Group. Hi, Chris.
Mindy, hi.
Chris, we want to start with you this hour because you have a story about what happens if a community doesn't agree with or trust your message. Would you share your story of taking a job as chief meteorologist at a TV station in Des Moines, Iowa?
Mindy, I never thought I'd leave my job in Boston. I loved it. I loved the city. I loved the job I had, which was communicating climate change during the week. It was doing the weather on the weekends. But this was an opportunity I couldn't turn down because it was talking to an audience, which the news director put it, really didn't have a background in climate change. And it was such an important issue because agriculture is a huge part of the economy out there. And I understood the assignment. This wasn't a one-size-fits-all approach in communicating climate change. You needed to tailor it to an audience. You couldn't preach. You couldn't be a climate activist on the air. You needed to provide the data. And I think for the most part, it was successful. I found ways to connect with a conservative audience by talking about how energy independence is harvesting the wind power in your own backyard. And that's truly a conservative talking point, energy independence. And fiscally irresponsible to let billion-dollar disasters just happen out of control, unmitigated, and not adapting to a changing climate. But there was pushback, which I expected, but I didn't expect a string of harassing emails that reached a peak when a gentleman from rural Iowa sent a death threat, which police investigated and later arrested him for third-degree harassment. Mm.
And, you know, to begin with, you had the support of the TV station, right? But that, as some of the criticism grew, that eroded away. You basically lost your job.
I mean, I didn't have much of an option because that was the reason why I went there. I didn't just take another weather job. This was an opportunity. And without that opportunity, really, I didn't feel comfortable in that position. And it's unfortunate because at the end of the day, when I left, the outpouring of support, hundreds of letters via email from Iowans. And what I did was I took post-it notes and I put post-it notes on the conservative communities. And there were a lot. And if you look at the Yale program on climate change communication, only 6% to 9% are dismissive of climate science. The rest of the population you can connect with and find ways to communicate. But I think what my station did was they listened to that loud minority, that 6 to 9% that just weren't happy. And they allowed them to editorialize the newscast, which was unfortunate.
Very unfortunate. And one of the things that you in the beginning of the book, you talk about when we encounter new knowledge, our brains really are kind of doing the best to make sense of it, right? We make assumptions based on a prior experience. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it really depends on the type of information. So if we, for example, learn about something very neutral, like a new species of bird in South America, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to be like, that doesn't exist, right off the bat. But if there's something that challenges our pre-existing worldview, how we see the world, how we see our place in the world, well, that information then, what happens is it encounters resistance. So what really the only way to overcome that resistance is finding others in our social network and our social community to be able to say, no, that's actually correct, right? And if we don't have that, if instead what often happens, like, for example, if we're in a social community, often that social community shares our beliefs, even if they're incorrect. And so we don't have the opportunity to then be challenged and be like, oh, and be told that, no, this is actually information that you can trust. So really, there's a great book called, I think it's called Change, How Big Things Happen by Damon Satola. And he talks about there's really two different ways to think about sharing information. One is through this, what we think of as like simple contagions, where it's just some kind of, we can spread it virally, like a job advertisement, right? It's just not going to generate any controversy. But if we want to share something that's going to maybe trigger that type of resistance, we need to really think about it as a complex contagion. And there we need to find trusted sources. So someone in our social network, someone that we can maybe identify with. We need to hear it multiple times, not just from the same person. It can't be the same, friend just n saying, you really should believe this, but we need to hear from multiple different sources. I do think that's where, for example, a trusted weather person can be, a great source if they're trusted, right? Because then they can, you can hear that, but that would just be one source. So it can't just only be on them. It has to be from, if we're really trying to change minds, we have to understand that it has to come from multiple trusted sources. And that's probably not going to necessarily happen from just like hearing broadcast. And you need to hear from like, your church or from your neighbors, right?
Heather, your thoughts on that? Because this is something you deal with in your job, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the words that have stood out to me as Chris and Anne have been talking, neutral, trust, and message, right? And I think so a lot of my work focuses on climate change, where, I think in terms of the trust that scientists want to have with the public, that has been traditionally based on the idea that if scientists are objective enough and detached enough from identity and social issues, that that can garner trust. And unfortunately, what has happened with the issue of climate change is that there's been a very concerted effort to link climate change with identity, politics, and particular worldviews. And so the ability of a neutral voice to actually break into there and have trust is really, really limited. And so instead, what we're going to have to do is find trusted messengers who, as Anne was saying, share some of those identity markers, share some of those worldviews, who can carry this message. Because again, that kind of objectivity is not necessarily going to build the trust that's needed to convey the message.
And I was I thought I really this was really interesting in the book. You talk about the three most trusted professions. Was the doctors were number one, teachers were number three, number two was scientists.
Right. Well, that's globally. In the US, I think it might be a little bit different, but it's still up there. We're so yeah, research, people have a lot of respect. Whenever I, if I'm a professor, I'm a researcher. If you share that information, people are always excited. It doesn't matter where you are. Like I one of experiences that I write about in the book is going to rural Pennsylvania and speaking with farmers about their perceptions of scientists. So I'm a, a liberal New York City, I teach in New York City. Social scientist, like kind of like a weird, insect from another place. But every single farmer received me onto the, onto their land, took the time. This was during harvest season as well, to speak with me about their perceptions. And so I think that like, create, you can definitely create those opportunities for having these like shared connections.
And that's another big, you have so many examples in the book of the importance of other perspectives. And I love the story about the farmers, because, in the one farmer that you talked to, he was not really fond of science and researchers, right? But he had a problem, like a lot of other farmers in that area. They were no-till soil. They're not plowing the soil. They're soybean farmers, and they find that they've got these slugs, and nobody can figure out what's going on. So talk about how he became, how he tr trusted this one researcher.
Yeah, so that, I think that's also one of my favorite stories from the book, and that came out from those interviews that I had. So I was just generally asking them, about their experiences with research, and they were saying, we don't necessarily find a lot of the research that's being done to be useful for our fields, our crops, et cetera. But then a couple of them mentioned, but there was one scientist who's different, and they mentioned this researcher, an entomologist at Penn State named John Tucker. And who at his grad student at the time, Maggie Douglas, who's now a professor at Dickinson College. And they talked about how John had actually responded to a problem that they had. And so when I later followed up on it, I spoke with John and revealed this really, really interesting story about, from his perspective, he was very new to his post. He was just had gotten to Penn State. He was in a partially extension position, which means that part of your job really is to, serve the needs of, in this case, farmers. So he was like, I'm not going to come up with research questions on my own. I'm going to see what research questions the farmers might have. And so first he tried to put out a survey. He tried to get the word out. And pretty quickly he started to get all these calls about slugs. So, a couple of the farmers said, can you come to this meeting just to breakfast? And he thought he was just going to go to this local breakfast place. There'd be a couple of farmers. So he goes and they've reserved the entire back room. And he said there were like 20 to 30 farmers there, all just waiting for him to explain what was going on with the slug problem. And he was completely taken by surprise, but he really felt like, okay, this is a need that I need to address. But interestingly, like slugs are not, they're in the mollusk family, right? They're not insects. So he was a little bit caught off guard, but he had this great graduate student. And together they started doing these experiments, putting known predators of the slugs, these types of carabid beetles, in with the soybean plant and with the slug to see what would happen. And what they found was that the beetles were dying, and they were like, what's happening? And they realized that they had the seed that they had planted was a seed that was treated with neonicotinoids. So neonicotinoids are the most widely used class of insecticides across the world. They're actually banned in Europe. They're very toxic. But they hadn't been seen. So if a beetle is right on the plant, it doesn't die. It doesn't get impaired. But if the beetle, what happens is the slug eats the plant, and then the beetle eats the slug, and then that's how the beetle gets impaired. So what was happening was the predators of the slugs were actually dying because of the planting of this insecticide. Because it was, and you couldn't get seeds really that were not treated with the insecticide. And this was hugely important because really there was before this, there was a lot of environmental groups trying to get the word out about the problem with neonicotinoids, but it didn't really seem important for corn and soybean farmers because they're not reliant on pollinators. So typically neonicotinoids are very toxic to pollinators. So this was a new finding that completely changed this idea about the problem of neonicotinoids, not just a problem for farmers that are reliant on pollinators, but also for farmers that are reliant on, the beetles,
Right.
all right,
Yeah.
that would protect them from the slugs.
It was interesting too when they go testify before the agriculture committee, they're kind of like ho hum listening, and then until it's like, and the farmers have no choice. What? The farmers have no choice. That was what really got them interested, right?
So, for years, environmental groups have been lobbying, trying to get the attention about this issue because of the environmental issue, also potential health issues, right? But this wasn't really getting the attention of policymakers. They're like, well, it's not hurting our corn and soybean crops, right? That's the main thing that we're concerned around. But this changed that conversation because suddenly the conventional corn and soybean farmers were not happy because they didn't have a choice. And so it created a policy opening for having a different conversation. And later, I've spoken to some of these farmers, even just as recently as a few months ago, and some of them have completely switched. They're not organic farmers. They don't like to be called organic farmers, but they're not using insecticides because they're not using this treated seed. So it's a great success story, and it's not just a great policy and practice story, but the article in question really changed some just basic knowledge on ecological science. It won the Editor's Choice Award in the Journal of Applied Ecology, which is one of the top journals in the field. So it's a really great science story as well.
Heather, thoughts on the importance of the different perspectives? When Anne was in the book talking about this, farmers and the extension agent working together, kind of made me think of here where we have like the scientists and the fishermen, the fishermen kind of, saying what's happening in the waters, like the farmers are telling them what's happening in their fields. Talk about that importance of perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that is really central in a lot of the work that we do at Woodwell Climate as well, right? So when we think about the history of Western science interacting with a whole range of different communities, just keep it in the US setting for the time being, right? There's a history of a lot of harm that was done to African American communities, to indigenous communities. There's very good reasons for the lack of trust. And at the same time, I think as Anne's story gets at and some of the statistics we've mentioned get at, there is a recognition of the need for information to make decisions, and especially in communities that are facing climate change and these really big environmental challenges, there is information that is needed. And so the building of trust and the working together to co-develop the understanding and the insights that are needed is really, really important. And I'll give you a couple of examples of how this is playing out in our work at Woodwell. So we work with under-resourced communities around the country and around the world to provide climate risk assessments free of charge. Now, on one hand, you could say, well, why don't you just put all of the models up on the web and anybody can just kind of go look at the results of the models and see what their flood risk or their heat risk or whatever is. And to some extent, that's true. But those assessments are really much, much better when they are co-developed with the communities that are going to be using them because they bring an immense amount of knowledge of their community. What are the social challenges that are fa they're facing? What is the history of this particular site where a mall was placed that's now really hardened? What is your experience of what flooding looks like and where the water actually moves in your community? And how do we build that into these risk assessments? And the end result are risk assessments that are far more useful and are just better quality risk assessments because they have that diversity of input into the understanding of what's going on in that physical and social setting.
Yeah, you got buy-in. You have buy-in as well. Yeah.
Well, it's buy-in, yes, but it's knowledge, right? So I think a growing awareness in the Western scientific community that the practices, the rules, the whole system that has been built up over the past several hundred years, that is now Western science and that kind of quote unquote scientific method is one really powerful way of developing new knowledge. But it's only one way of developing new knowledge. And it does is not the sole arbiter and holder of all knowledge. And so that recognition that we need all of these different kinds of information and understanding to really formulate a holistic understanding of what's going on in our world and make good decisions, I think is really, really important. And one of the really exciting trends, I think, in science now, this is definitely in our work at Woodwell, really central, but across the science community, a growing understanding of the real importance of Indigenous knowledge and traditional knowledge around the world, and the dimension that that brings to our understanding. And so we're working with communities in Alaska Native communities, and again, looking at risk and changing environment, and being able to build the trust and relationship and co-develop, ask questions together of like, okay, well, this is what we think we know from a Western science perspective. This is what we know from an Indigenous perspective, having been here for thousands of years and watching the environment change. All right, where can we work together to develop new understanding of how the environment is changing and what that means for these communities, and do so in a way that really benefits the communities and sets them up for a more resilient future. And so it's really, really exciting to see that recognition from the science community, the Western science community, of the power of other ways of learning and knowing, and what that can do to benefit all of us.
All right. Chris, you want to add anything to all that?
I mean, a large part of what we're doing at Woods Hole Group is when we work with communities, we don't just come in as experts. We get to engage with the community and listen to their concerns, right? When I was in Boston, I did a story, and this was the only story that received pushback, and it's unfortunate. It was on how Black and Brown communities are hit harder by the climate crisis. And I went back to the descriptions of what redlining looked like in these neighborhoods back then. And those neighborhoods still look very similar today in Boston, even though the Fair Housing Act was passed. But the idea is, it's not like the storm is stronger there, but they're around the sources of pollution. They're around the sources of limited green space. So it's important to make sure that everyone is at the table when you're having these conversations, instead of going in and saying, we need to, reduce, maybe travel through these areas. But we know we need to do a better job with public transportation, making sure that it's green and environmentally friendly. So I think that that is one of the most important parts of what we do, is making sure that we hear every voice in the community. And that's the only way that we can effectively build a resilient society in the face of climate change.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing strategies for scientists to improve communication with the public about research and findings and rebuild trust between the public and science. With us is Anne Toomey, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Science at Pace University. She's the author of the book Science with Impact: How to Engage People, Change Practice, and Influence Policy. Heather Goldstone, Chief Communications Officer at Woodwell Climate Research Center. And Chris Gloninger, Senior Climate Scientist at the Woods Hole Group. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And you spent some time in Bolivia working on your PhD, and you write, over-research has been raised as an ethical concern in research, and it can have major impacts for communities. As I found during my PhD work in Bolivia, communities that experience a steady trickle of researchers, many of whom may only stay for months or weeks, and who do not return the results of their findings, can lead to resentment, suspicion, and ultimately closed doors. I had no idea that there was so much research going on in this one particular area in Bolivia. And these poor people, they're cooperating, and they never get to see the results of all of this research.
Yeah, and you know, to make matters worse, mostly these were indigenous communities, and I think part of it is there's this real fascination currently with, you know, indigenous knowledge, which is great, but what the kind of the impact of that can be, there's this, you know, a lot of graduate students, masters and PhD students, and like myself, I'll include myself in that, thinking, going in, coming up with some research project that will be useful. Like, I'm so unique in this idea that I want to study indigenous knowledge in Latin America, right? Like, it's very white savory, and it does lead to this over research in certain communities, especially like the more accessible communities. And I had heard some real horror stories. One community told me about archaeologists who had come in and actually taken some of their ceramics and left and promised to come back, and they had never returned. Mm. And you know, often what happens, I don't think people are malintentioned. I think what happens is that there's really no funding for dissemination. There's no funding to go back. You know, if you don't plan for it in advance, especially if you're a student, you're not necessarily supported. Okay, now it's time to go back to the community and share the results. Like, no, it's like your mentors are pushing you. Okay, you got to get a job. You got to publish in X journal. But this accountability, responsibility to actually going back and presenting not just the findings, like not just handing back a thesis written in, you know, English, but like, how do you actually share that back in a way that is meaningful? And I think that is actually a pretty underexplored area of research in itself. Like, how do we actually do this in a way that means something? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I share an example in the book about trying to do that through a documentary film, which actually fell flat. And I explain a little bit why I felt like it fell flat. And mainly it's because I didn't really consider, I didn't consult beforehand on, like, before I came up with a brilliant plan to to make this film, you know. Mm-hmm.
Heather, what are your thoughts on that? Like, because you do research all over the world. How do you share that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think actually the systemic issues start well before we get to sharing back research results. Anne mentioned there's not necessarily funding to go back to a community, but one of the biggest impediments, I think, to doing truly collaborative, relevant, and beneficial science is that there's no funding for relationship building, right? So when I first got to Woodwell, I was talking with some of our scientists who were starting to work with various different communities where trust and relationship building was really important. What I kept hearing from them was, well, but we can't get funding to just go be in community for days, a week at a time, right? We have to show that we're there sharing research results or doing something or, extracting knowledge. We have to be doing something while we're there. And in a lot of cases, what is needed is just time to be together as people, and building trust and relationships. And so there's a real systemic issue. And I think that reveals something even deeper about science and why there is this eroding trust in science as an institution, which is that respect and understanding of the importance of trust and relationships just hasn't been there. There's just been an expectation by the Western science community that because of our expertise, we should be trusted and we don't need to put in effort. And I think that's starting to shift, but I think it's something that really needs to shift.
Chris, what are your thoughts on that?
I think as a science, we need to do a better job with representation as well, and who is doing this research, right? And I was fortunate to have a meteorology professor that was from Puerto Rico. She did all of her schooling from there. And Dr. Sorry, John Morales, a meteorologist, a former colleague, became a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, and he said representation matters. I was at a university speaking at a panel, and I will not say which one, but a staff member, someone that was a professor there, was questioned about research after Hurricane Maria, and he said, "Well, a lot of our funding is for stateside research." That is a horrible disconnect. I mean, that is completely unacceptable, but we need to have representation, and it shouldn't just be white people that are doing the research in these areas. We need to have get people inspired to get into this field to do this research from areas that are not just, within the states.
Bringing up two things here. I'm thinking education and I'm thinking funding. But let me talk about funding for a second here, because you all know, you're scientists. All the things you'd like, the research you'd like to do, doesn't get. You have to have some sort of an idea of where this is headed, right? You kind of suspect what your outcome is going to be, that you can present that to somebody who goes, okay, I'll fund that. But just to go find some answers, which we should be doing, right, doesn't always get funded. I don't think the general public has any idea how difficult it is to get funding for these research projects. Who wants to take that on?
I can take that on. I just wanted to, agree also with what Heather was saying about, the relationship building piece. I think, and experienced this many times with just a lot of rejected proposals, in that if you write something like, "We are going to work with this group to finalize these questions," you might as well just throw the proposal in the garbage, because no review panel wants to read that. They want to know exactly what you're going to do, how you're going to do it, and what the outcomes are going to be, or what the expected outcomes are going to be. They might be interested in maybe having a little bit of flexibility around how you're going to share that out, but you can't like say, "All right, we're going to spend a year working on with this group to make sure this is the right question," And there's, like Heather was saying, there's no funding for that. So I don't, it's so interesting because there's a willingness to invest $5 million, for example, like some NSF grants are up to $5 million that I've applied for. Just investing that into a project, but why is there not 10,000, $5,000 even dollars to provide this type of seed money? I mean, there's seed money sometimes we have at universities to get a grant, but usually it's just like to have academics talk to each other. Why can't we have seed funding to have that first year of creating this type of relationship? I mean, that seems like a very good investment for not that much money. You don't have to spend $5 million to have seed money.
I'll say one thing at Woodwell Climate that has been a game changer for us in doing a lot of work in community is philanthropic funding. Either foundation or individual donor philanthropic funding, where there is that values connect, there is an understanding and a commitment to doing things in a different way. And there's also, within that system, the flexibility to, yes, change your research questions, to change your timeline. There's a flexibility that isn't always there with federal funding. And so again, that's two sides of the coin. We need systemic change in how we fund and think about the scientific process. There may also be opportunities or needs to seek different systems that can support the kind of work that needs to happen.
You say in the book, one of the biggest misconceptions about science is that it is a collection of facts rather than a process of inquiry. And that science education, this is what we're teaching students, right? That you have to have the right answer. And that really isn't what science is about. And we need to be teaching differently, right, Anne?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most exciting thing that I've come to love about science is this discovery, you know, this constant uncertainty and willingness to engage and to inquire and to think and to question, right? And that's not really often how it's taught. There's a great example of a course that I heard about. It's a professor at Columbia, Stuart Feinstein, who has a course called Ignorance, How It Drives Science. And he wrote a book on this as well. And I just found that so inspirational because it's this idea that instead of teaching, well, apparently he came to want to develop this course because the book that he was teaching was like 7 pounds and like 1,000 pages. And the students just came in to, really it was neuroscience course, came in thinking, okay, everything is already known about the brain. Like we know everything, but well, actually, you know, there's like, that's just 1% of probably what we need to know, right? So how can we teach students to start asking their own questions and get excited about what's not known, right? And I think it's really hard. I find that I work with a lot of undergraduates, graduate students, and I find that there's a struggle. And I remember myself, you know, at that age, we tend to think in very black and white, right? When we're younger, and we wanted to have the answer. We don't like uncertainty. I mean, we don't like uncertainty, period, as a human, but especially when we're younger, this you know, getting students to feel comfortable with it's okay if you don't know, and it's okay if you have these questions, and actually that's what this is. And just one other study I want to mention, there was research that was done on what made students do better in science and get more inspired in science classes. And they did these different interventions, and some were to share stories of successful scientists, and some were to share stories of scientists who struggled. And the stories of scientists who struggled were far more powerful. The stories of the scientists who were successful had negative effects on learning and perceptions of them as scientists. So we need to be able to share our own stories of trial and challenge and failure in a way that like students are like, oh, okay, I'm not like the only one, you know, the odd person out here.
Yeah. A lot of struggle in science for sure, right?
Yeah.
And to your point, Chris, about encouraging, you know, more people to enter science, I think and you talk about this in the book, you're thinking like, you never thought you'd be a scientist, right? I mean, that was like, I don't excel in this class or that class, but they're kids are, you know, they're curious by nature, and maybe we need to do a better job of nurturing that in some of the younger grades, right?
I absolutely, and I think we need to do a better job in allowing people to ask questions. And I think I will caution, it is a slippery slope. And if you look at what has happened to social media, for example, I'll use what happened with the yesterday's storm. It was 60 degrees in New York, 3 times more likely because of climate change, this warmth. Records, though, from the 1930s show that temperatures were into the 60s as well back then. But that's taken and twisted into a way that there's so much that we don't know about the science. However, if you look at and pull back the layers, we're outpacing record warmth 3-1 compared with record cold. So it's important to also relay that. And yes, there are a lot of uncertainties in climate science. There are uncertainties, but climate scientists, atmospheric scientists have looked at every other single cause of climate change. And really, the only correlation, the only connection that makes sense is that human connection of CO2 emissions. But that's taken and flipped as there's so much uncertainty, you can't say that it's settled science. Well, that part of the science, we've really exhausted every other possibility. And this is where we've landed.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after break. You're listening to The Point, and we are discussing strategies for scientists to improve communication with the public about research and findings and to rebuild trust between the public and science. With us is Anne Toomey, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Science at Pace University, the author of Science with Impact, How to Engage People, Change Practice, and Influence Policy. Also with us, Heather Goldstone, Chief Communications Officer at Woodwall Climate Research Center, and Chris Glonginger, Senior Climate Scientist at Woods Hole Group. 866-999-4622. 26 is our number, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, you have a whole section here, and scientists are told to stay out of politics and are encouraged to try and influence policymaking. So what's that distinction between politics and policymaking?
Well, I think, you know, the point I try to make in the book is that there is a distinction that we can actually say, well, policymaking is, you know, we could potentially be incorporating different sorts of evidence into making an informed decision, whereas politics might be something more like negotiating and compromise and being like pushed in one way or the other. So there can be a little bit of a distinction, but I think the point is that distinction is really up for debate in terms of how we perceive whoever is doing the acting, mm-hmm. right? So we might see something as, oh, I'm just providing evidence, but given the type of evidence and who we are, might be perceived, no, you're just influenced, you're trying to influence politics here. This is mm-hmm. political, right? And so that's why, for example, some things like the March for Science, right? Many people saw that as just, well, we're just standing up for science, we're just standing up for facts. But for others, it could have been seen very much as a political, radical act of advocacy for, you know, for a given political view. And so really, depending on who you're speaking with, policymaking and politics can be like very mushed together. Yeah. So we need to tread carefully. And I think, you know, one of the most important things that we need to be aware of as researchers is that if we don't know what we're doing, we should tread very, very, very carefully. And it's very hard to understand. The policy making landscape is extremely complex. I've spoke with folks who are lobbyists, registered lobbyists, and they're like, listen, you want to influence policy, like get ready for, you know, like 5 to 10 years of your life, because that's really what it takes. You need to understand the coalition that's trying to build some kind of getting first a bill on the table, then getting that bill into law. Like there's so much that goes into it. You need to know the different players. You need to know, you know, the different agencies, where decisions are being made and how to pivot if you hit a dead end. And so I think sometimes there's this idea that, oh, I just need to call my congressperson for an audience. Well, they might listen to you politely, you know, but it doesn't mean that's going to be a major influence on their thinking, you know. Actually, probably a better investment of time would be to form a relationship with a staff person and see where, you know, they might be on a given issue, or better yet, you know, offer your services to a group that's already advocating for the same issue and saying, like, how can I help? How can I just join that? I think the point is we just need to be very careful in how we approach things, because it could make things worse. There could be a coalition already moving towards something, but really working on the timing of it. And then if, you know, we go ahead and post a bunch of tweets, it could just generate,
some negativity. Chris, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think the media has kind of failed us in this light as well. When you have more than 99% of degreed scientists that have researched this for, you know, they're living their career supporting anthropogenic climate change, human-caused climate change, but you're showing one face on air, that really sends a bad message that there isn't consensus.
Right.
When you have politicians that are the poster child for this movement, I think that that's also sending a bad message. This may be an unpopular opinion, but when Al Gore became the face of climate change, somebody that is not a true scientist, I think that you could trace the roots of it becoming a politicized issue to around that time. And in Anne's book, you saw that divide spreading between concern about climate change. I think mm-hmm. it was very close between 52% that were Democrats that were concerned versus 48% that were Republican, 48%. But that divide has just grown over time.
Right.
And, if you're interviewing politicians on MSNBC, on CNN, about climate change, of course, it's going to become political.
Yeah. And Heather, many people know, is a journalist. She was a scientist, then a journalist, and now a scientist again. But we've had many conversations about that, about giving weight, like when in the, you know, most of the science community is in agreement, and then you've got this, as Chris says, 1%. You can't give equal weight there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think there's a lot there. And Chris, 100% on your hot take, where I think, I guess I would make a different distinction, maybe not policymaking versus politics. I would distinguish between political and partisan, right? And the problem with Al Gore as a messenger for all of the incredible good that he has done is that he is an inherently partisan figure, which enhances the polarization and the partisan nature of the climate conversation. And you know, I'll take that a step further. At Woodwell Climate, we are deeply involved in policymaking conversations, talking with folks on the Hill, working with policymakers in Brazil, in the DRC, around the world, working with municipal leaders, right? And our founder, George Woodwell, stalwart of the Woods Hole community until he passed away earlier this year, loved to kind of rile people up by saying, oh no, science is political. Science is inherently political. And at one point I asked him about this and dug into it a little bit. And what he meant was science has the ability to inform our decision-making and to move the world forward on issues like poverty alleviation, resilience, food security, inherently social and political issues, right? And he felt strongly that it should, and that's why Woodwell Climate Research Center was founded, was to put science into the hands of decision makers and influence decision making. I think where we have hit problems is where that becomes partisan, and also I think there was a really problematic. Here's my unpopular take. I think there was a really problematic kind of push in the 90s for science-based policy, and what that turned into was the idea that science should dictate policy. No, information and knowledge should be part of the decision-making process, but values, social context are equally critical, if not even more in some cases, right? And so when you say, well, it should be based on science, and the science tells us we should do X, Y, and Z, that's where you get into problems. And the role of science is not to tell us what we should do, but to help us understand what the ramifications of different decisions might be so that policymakers can then wrestle with that in the context of their values and their community to figure out what is the best path forward. Right. And when we try to diminish that role of values, I think we get into a really problematic place where science then becomes the target of, well, I don't believe your science because it tells me that I have to do something that I don't want to do on a values level. And that's, I think, where we've gotten into a lot of issues with climate, with vaccines, with a whole host of issues where the science has become the target in a political setting.
Right. And one thing you had in the book that I thought was fascinating, and you this was about the tobacco industry, where David Michaels wrote in his book, Doubt is Their Product. Industry has learned that debating the science is much easier and more effective than debating the policy.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, just kind of going off with what Heather was saying, you know, I think that COVID, really, we saw this during COVID, right? There was this whole, a lot of folks in political positions were saying, we're just following the science. But actually, no, I mean, the science was it was evolving, right? And follow the science, it means, well, you're kind of like reading a different paper every day and trying to really get a grasp of things. Really what it was about was making choices, right? Were we choosing to save as many lives, or were we choosing to educate, like, you know, uphold the highest standards of education for our children? Those were choices that we were making at different times. And sometimes we were choosing, okay, everybody stay home, even if this means that a lot of kids are not going to really get access to education for a year. That was a choice. So, you know, and to say it's following, we need to be very clear about like what values we're choosing. And again, like kind of how Heather was saying, it's like to really hide behind this idea that science is this neutral arbiter is not a helpful message. Because there is a lot of, uncertainty. But like, yeah, I mean, it is uncertainty is weaponized. I do think there's an important point to make about different types of uncertainty. So we can say that there's uncertainty in the consensus, which is often what a lot of climate deniers will say, which is untrue. And we should challenge that and say, no, that is incorrect. There's not uncertainty in the consensus. Versus uncertainty in a given study. And there's differing, we interpret things differently. So if we say we don't, like, scientists don't know what's going on with climate change, well, that's going to make people feel unsecure, insecure. But if we say, well, there's a this in this particular study, this is what we don't know. And so this other study then helps to shed light on that. That's different. And so I think that it's important also for researchers to understand that there's different ways to communicate about uncertainty.
Yeah. What about engaging skeptics? How what is your thoughts on that? I mean, so sometimes you get somebody who's got this misinformation or wrong information, and you go, "Well, that's not exactly right." Sometimes those conversations don't go the way you think they would go. Right? Goes back to the what our brain is doing.
Right.
You know, going on our assumptions. Who has thoughts on engaging skeptics?
I can jump in. You
Go
know,
ahead.
it's funny. I mean, as soon as you know the tone of an email or a tweet or a message, you know which way to go. And you know, for example, I saw somebody post the Statue of Liberty 100 years ago versus today from afar saying there's no such thing as climate change. Well, if they don't understand the fact that there are tides that fluctuate many feet per day and that from that vantage point, a foot of sea level rise wouldn't look like a whole lot, you just know that that person is not willing to, in good faith, engage in a conversation.
Right.
So I think you really need to look at tone, because that 9% of people that are dismissive, you will not be able to connect with.
Right. Anybody want to add anything to that, Heather?
Yeah, I would just say I have a really short adage that I try to stick to, which is ask more questions than you answer.
Ah, yeah, that's a good one.
Right? Go into it trying to understand where the other person is coming from, trying to find connection. And in fact, there's some research that shows that if what you're trying to do is change somebody's mind, and you go into it saying, "Hey, you should change your mind to X, Y, and Z," it's not going to happen. That if you're truly interested in finding space for change, that asking questions can do more to help a person change their own mind than telling them
Yeah.
something can.
Anne?
Right.
Questions?
Yeah, I would just agree with that. I mean, I think there's this I guess I would kind of call it a movement. Deep canvassing is a great type of approach that's been used all around the country to have conversations, door-to-door conversations with people about controversial issues. And what they do differently, it's not your typical door-to-door, like, these are the facts, this is what I think. It's they actually try to have an exchange of narratives. And so there's a lot of questions that go into that. They start with questions. How do you feel about this? Can you tell me? Do you have, and also to Chris's point, like, if someone says, well, I'm 100% convinced of X, all right, move on to the next door, because you're probably not going to get much out of that. So I think there's a lot we can learn from, yeah, just being curious.
Yeah. Just we only have about a minute left, so I don't want to ask another question. It's going to take longer. So anybody have any like closing thoughts they'd like to share in our final minute? All of a sudden, everybody's silent. Heather?
I guess I'll just a quick one, which is, I think we kind of came into this with the framing of like we're going to talk about science communication. And I guess my take on that is that science communication is not inherently any different than any other communication, right? What we're really talking about is building trust, building relationships, being credible, authentic human beings, and sharing the information that we have and being open to the knowledge and experience that others have.
Yeah, good point. Heather Goldstone's Chief Communications Officer at Woodwell Climate Research Center, Chris Glonginger's Senior Climate Scientist at the Woods Hole Group, and Anne Toomey's Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Science at Pace University. She's the author of the book Science with Impact: How to Engage People, Change Practice, and Influence Policy. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you all. Very interesting hour. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.